SB Nation and Underdog Dynasty present the Underdog Podcast.
And welcome back to the Underdog Podcast, your home for AAC football. We are back with another episode, and it seems like even though we have a bunch of content to do, to talk about, we get more and more to discuss as the offseason goes on. And actually, this is a topic that we'll start with that Dan and I literally just started talking about. So as usual, I'm your host, Joe Broback. That is Dan Morrison. You know where to find us. I'm at Joe Broback. He's at Dan Morrison. Is it 96?
You forgot my underscore.
Dan underscore Morrison. You're the underscore. That's right. Dan underscore Morrison, thank you.
Acknowledge the underscore.
Hey, you know what? Joe and Eric both have underscores too. And every time I talk with them, I give them a hard time. I'm like, well, you know what? Just figure it out.
Yeah. You could join the club, or you could. Yeah.
You know what? Maybe I could, but you know what? I'm good. So let's dive into it because we have a lot to talk about here. Just with our team previews, we're going to continue that today. We're talking ECU. We're going to talk about the running backs in the AAC. But first, we're going to talk about a debate that UCF fans are having, and it's one that I think is we honestly within the minute that we talked about it, I was already intrigued by what you had to say, and I'll kind of let you set this up because I'm not too familiar with what the two sides are. So kind of tell everybody what's going on with UCF.
Yeah. So this goes back to the college football playoff expansion recommendation that was made. I was on Twitter a couple of days ago, actually. I saw a bunch of the guys from the Black and Gold Banneret website. We're talking with a few other people in the UCF kind of, I hate to say Twitter community because that's such a weird phrase, but a bunch of people who support UCF on Twitter. And there's this debate that's been going on that I got too deep into the weeds of, and I really needed to save myself from, of who is most to credit for this expansion recommendation. Is it Danny White, the former UCF, now Tennessee athletic director, who declared a national championship and was very loud and kind of forced a lot of people to confront that inequality? Was it the team itself who actually went out there and won those games and said, hey, we're really, really good? Was it Mike Oresko, the athletic director? Or was it none of the above, and it's just the way the game was going, it's the money flow to it, and it's people like Jack Swarbrick, the Notre Dame athletic director, Greg Sankey, the SEC commissioner, who they're the ones who actually came up with the proposal, and they're the ones who should be given the credit. In my opinion, it's probably a blend. I think the most important thing to it was, hey, there's a lot of money to be made in expanding the playoff. Right now you've got three games, and you can make it what would it be like 12? No, not 12 games, not that many. My math is terrible. But you can get like triple the number of games out of it, something like that. Yeah, there's a lot more money to be made there. And I think that was the first calling card. And I think the second thing, to an extent, it is inclusivity, but I don't think you can give Danny White all the credit in the world for that because, well, the players did need to go out there and actually win the game, start to count. And, you know, here we are.
I think there's three tiers to it. I think the first one is, like you said, the playoffs was going to expand one way or another. Eventually, it was going to happen. I think, though, that – so that's the first one because it was going to happen regardless. I think we can agree on that. But I think the thing that got this maybe sped up is the fact that UCF won 25 games in a row and got to that point. So I would give them the second and they got it.
I give that to the players, not Danny White, if we're getting into who deserves that credit.
Yes, 100%. And then you could put, you know, Scott Frost. And I would give Scott Frost the more of the credit than Josh Heupel because Josh Heupel just kind of like stood there and was a body. But I would give the team.
Go Vols.
Yeah, I would give the team, you know, Mackenzie Milton, Shaquem Griffin, those guys, I would give them the second because I think they sped up that process because while the playoff was going to expand, if a team like UCF doesn't come around and it's like another 10-2,
Boise State or whoever,
you know, teams like that, I think we're still having a 4-team playoff for a while. So I think the fact that they did so well is the biggest reason. And then you throw in last year's Cincinnati and Coastal Carolina. I think that was a big part of the G5, at least. I think Texas A&M not getting in was also a huge mm-hmm. thing. Once you start involving those powers,
yeah,
escalates things. But I think the fact that UCF went undefeated in the regular season 2 years in a row and didn't even sniff the top four, it was a big part in escalating mm-hmm. that to a new level. And then I think you do have to give Danny White some credit, because it doesn't matter if you win all those games, if your athletic director is just like, oh yeah, we're good, and doesn't really like stir the pot, I think that mm-hmm. you aren't at that point. I don't think Mike Oresko really is any different than Danny White. I think Danny White did more promoting of his program or his school than Oresko mm-hmm. did. So I would give Danny White more credit than Mike Oresko for sure, but not as much as the first two.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that we don't like to talk about in the group of five bubble kind of deal is how much this really comes down to Greg Sankey and Jack Swarbrick. The SEC and Notre Dame really made it 12 teams, not six or eight when they expanded first. And there's two basic reasons for this. Jack Swarbrick, I'm going to start there because I know it a little bit better just because of the Notre Dame thing in me. He, in the current playoff system, was willing to make this really – it's a really awful deal for Notre Dame. I know people don't like hearing Notre Dame gets kind of screwed by it, but Notre Dame has to go unbeaten to make the playoff. Notre Dame doesn't play an FCS game. They play about 9 or 10 Power 5 teams a year. They play one of the toughest schedules every year, whether you want to admit it or not. They have to go and beat in to make the playoff as it is now, because they don't play in a conference championship game. And that's the deal. Simple as that. They get to keep their independence. This new system, they would very rarely get that first round bye anyways, but they're giving it up now. So Swarbrick has to get that credit for giving up that little advantage, making a compromise about the Notre Dame thing. And frankly, it's better for Notre Dame now because by and large, they'll be in the playoff every single year. They'll actually start winning major games once in a while instead of walking to Clemson or Alabama and not having the manpower for it.
Well, I think that one thing that they actually have a little bit of an advantage because, one, they don't have to win a conference championship. They don't get the other time with that, which, like, I want to get rid of those anyways. I think they're a waste of time. Yeah. And two,
as long as they make money, they're not a waste of time.
Right. The top four seeds don't get a home game. So the best that Notre Dame can do is five, and they get a home game. Why wouldn't you? You have to play one more.
Absolutely.
Game, but you get a home game.
Oh yeah, they'll be getting a home game at number five, most likely against a group of five team in each of those games. So you're telling me that Notre Dame doesn't want to host, let's say Memphis, for a kind of random AAC team that they feel they should beat any single year because they're Notre Dame. They recruit at the level they recruit. They are who they are. So no, obviously they'd want that. It's such a big boost just to get the ticket sales and everything. The other person I mentioned was Greg Sankey, though, the SEC commissioner. And from my understanding was he was unwilling to go to a system that had less at-large bids than it currently does now, which is four. So if you go to eight teams and you're trying to make it more inclusive, and really the issue is, hey, not like the Pac-12 can't get in ever, and that's really hurting them and the game's not becoming national. We need to go to eight teams. Sankey wasn't going to allow it unless there were eight at-larges, because how are you going to do four invites? It was going to be awkward. So it ended up getting pushed up to 12 because of that.
Yeah. And we talked about this last episode, the fact that the Power Five conferences were going to have to get on board with it, because it doesn't matter how much the G5 complains that the Power Five's not on board, it doesn't matter. And while it has more to do with Sankey thinking, hey, I could get four or five teams in the playoff, it doesn't matter, because all, and I think this is what people don't understand, is they're mad because they're like, well, it doesn't matter for the group of five. It's like, no, this is literally what we wanted. If you paid attention, mm-hmm. you'd understand that. Is
it's a route to make it.
They wanted a chance because, Jamie Chadwell, the Coastal Carolina head coach, said that now his guys, he can tell recruits that they actually have a chance to win a national championship. Mm-hmm. Now, is it a good chance? That's a whole nother debate. But there's a chance. Whereas before, it's like, we have no chance of playing for a national championship. And I think that's one thing that's a super underrated part is the fact that before it's like, well, if you go to Alabama, Ohio State, Clemson, Oklahoma, some of the top 10 teams. Like, really, those are the only teams that you can say, yeah, we have a shot to win a national championship. Now, every single team, okay, well, not every single team, but more teams.
Go UMass.
Group of five, like, yeah, what is, you know, stick to hockey. But, like, Cincinnati can tell, like, Luke Fickell can tell his kids now, hey, you can come here and you can still get to the NFL and you can still compete for a national championship. And teams like Cincinnati, the UCFs, those kind of teams, they have a good chance of benefiting more from this expansion overall, because now they have a chance they can get better kids to come to their campus. And maybe that balances things out. Maybe it doesn't, but I think that you're expanding things. And like we said last time, there are things that still need to be fixed with college football, but you have to take a step one way or another, and this is just one of those steps.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, it's going to be interesting. Again, I would give it to the fact that expansion was going to happen regardless of anybody said or what anybody did. But UCF, the players definitely escalated that because they went undefeated and they sparked outrage because no one gave them a chance, even though they, you know, we want excellence, but all of a sudden two undefeated teams aren't exactly excellent. So it's like, well, what do you really want here?
Completely.
Anyways, so we'll move on here. That was it's always nice to talk about when UCF's involved and and you know, you could definitely go all day talking about anything with UCF Twitter, UCF the Mafia, or whatever they call themselves.
UCF Twitter Mafia.
Shout out to them, man. They're fun. They're a lot of fun, regardless of if you're agreeing or disagree with them. I have a bunch of them that follow me, and I enjoy every single time that I interact with them, regardless of what they have to say. So we'll move on here, though, to dive more into the AAC. So we're continuing our position ranking discussion, too. The running backs are up this time. Last time we did the quarterbacks, in addition to the Cincinnati podcast. So if you haven't listened to that, make sure you go check that out. Make sure you go look at Underdog the Dynasty to see the articles that are posted. We have a lot going on right now, actually, with playoff and position rankings and preseason stuff. So talking about the running backs, and honestly, when I was putting this list together, there were a lot of names that I didn't realize like were returning and are still back. And I think when you look at, there are probably, honestly, there's four teams that I considered elite. I'm curious to hear what you have to say, but there's also three other teams that could be right in that discussion. So I want to know your thoughts. What did you agree with? What did you disagree with? And feel free to don't hold.
Yeah. Well, I thought you got number one and two flipped. I think Tulsa's got the best running back room in the conference overall.
Well,
I think
they've got, real quick, if TK Wilkerson didn't retire and Corey Taylor returned, then I don't know. They would have been probably 1A, 1B, but because there's only two, it's only Shamari Brooks and Denaire Prince. That's why I have them too.
I still really like them. I love Ulysses Bentley, but I think he's kind of solo act out at SMU more or less in terms of what you're getting from them on offense, but that's fine. That's what they're looking to do. But I think Ulysses Bentley, for ranking running backs by name, but by like team, I think Tulsa's ahead of SMU. And then you go 3-4, I'd swap those again. I think UCF, Cincy, I think they're in a similar boat where you know who one of the guys is, Ford and Thompson respectively. But then UCF's got a couple of transfers coming in. Cincinnati's got to replace Jared Doakes. You know, so there's a couple question marks for each of them, but I think you're pretty confident with those running back rooms. And then I'm going to skip down a little bit to Memphis at 8, who you had, I believe, listed as a need more information, which it's just so weird to see Memphis down there, isn't it?
Right? It's kind of sad.
Because I was thinking about it. I was like, no, it's Memphis. They have a great running back. And I was like, but what's his name? What's his name? I was like, that's right. Because
they have four
dudes. You could list the guys who are gone.
Right. There are four dudes that couldn't be, but that like
honestly, I would say that's Memphis is a top five running back room in the conference, but at the same time, you can't say for sure why, other than they should be, because that's who they've been.
Last year, they relied on Brady White a lot more than they should have.
Brady White was a perfectly fine college quarterback, but I don't think he was good enough to rely on the way they did, at least not consistently. I think they're, well, we've talked about Memphis briefly in the past, and we'll talk more about them in our preview, but I think they're going to take a little step back. Then going down, I was a little surprised you had Houston so low. I think that, no, you don't think it's bad.
I'm not. I mean, so here's the thing. The last few years, I've been like way too high in Houston. I think they like, I always put them higher. So this year I was like, let's just try to be super realistic. And while like Tajon Henry has a lot of potential to be a great back, as does Mo Bakar, like I don't know what this offense is going to do. First of all, I haven't seen anything from the rushing attack that's like, yeah, they're going to just dominate. So I put them down there and they can surprise me and I'll gladly be wrong.
I do this thing with Houston's offense every single year since Holgorsen got there, where I go, at least last year, I'll use, for example, go Mo Bakar up the middle when they're like, you know, then you got Stevens on the outside so they can blow the top off you. It's going to be great. They're always going to have the matchup one, and it just hasn't clicked yet, and I'm waiting for it to click. And I still, like, for whatever reason, even though the guys on Houston's roster right now haven't proven that they can do it at that level, something about them, maybe it's just because they're Houston, you just expect them to figure it out one year and be this offensive juggernaut. But you're right, they haven't proven anything in terms of their actual ability to.
Well, and Dana's pass, too, it tells you that it should be an, a lot better offense. It should be an explosive offense. But for whatever reason, I still say that, like, Major Applewhite just gutted this roster.
Yeah.
And obviously not on purpose. He thought he was bringing in the right guys. But this roster has just been full of, like, frustrating and disappointing players. And that has more to do with it. That's what I keep saying. But, like,
but we're year three now, and I know.
Yeah.
I know years one and two were as weird as years one and two can be for a head coach, between the redshirt situation in 2019 and COVID in 2020. But at some point you need to see that development, and you can't keep saying it's Major Applewhite, because at some point they're Dana's guys.
Right. And
if they stuck around, they're Dana's guy.
You can definitely say that this is Dana's team. And even though there's still a lot of guys, like Clayton Tune's running the show, and that's not Dana's guy, but Tune is still a good quarterback. I think that he can do really well in Dana's system. So this is the first year that I'm like, because a lot of fans were like, well, Dana should be winning more than he is right now, but he's not. And it's like, well, he's also trying to rebuild the roster, because there's a lot of guys there are a couple of guys that I watched in the last 2 years where I'm like, you do not belong on this field. Mm-hmm. And they don't have a better option. And granted, injuries also didn't help them. But I think this is the first year that you can actually sit down and look at Dana's program and see what is going to happen with them and where are they headed. And honestly, like, there needs to be a bowl game involved for me to be on board. And that starts with running the football. If they're not going to be able to pass as well as they have, at West Virginia.
Yeah. I mean, I think as long as you've got Clayton Tune as your quarterback, you're not going to be able to pass the way Will Greer's West Virginia teams did. It's just, those two players are on a different level, a different wavelength in terms of what they can do physically on the field. I think Clayton Tune's a nice quarterback, but I don't think he's the guy to get you over the hump either. I think he plays the level of everyone else around him. If you give him time and give him weapons, he'll look really good. If you don't, he's going to look real bad.
Yeah. And decision making early in the season wasn't exactly great. So that's another thing that I'd be watching, but this is a guy who, I mean, he can make all the throws. I'm not worried about his arm talent. It's just a matter of, can the thing between his ears work when he needs it to, and can there be enough talent around him to give him a chance? And the biggest thing, I think, honestly, speaking of, everything mental, is can the offensive line actually play to the level that they're capable of and actually give him time to throw? Because that was another big issue for them. But, that's just, we're going to talk next week. We're going to talk about the wide receivers with them, and there's a lot to discuss there, but now we're going to move on to the ECU Pirates, a team that I have, ever since Holton Ahlers arrived on campus, I have been supporting, thinking that they're going to do better, and they continually disappoint me. And last year was no different. Even though it's a shortened year, they went 3-6, and you know, we're entering a critical stage under Mike Houston where now it's time to actually produce. Yeah. And I think that honestly, I'm very optimistic, and I know I've said that the last like 2 to 3 years, but I think there are pieces returning that we're going to discuss that have a lot of potential to make, get this team to a bowl game, to finish 500. But another thing we'll talk about is the schedule, which I don't know. We're going to have to find Dan. I'm going to make you find 6 wins for me on this.
Schedule. Okay. I think I can find 6 wins for you in a minute, but first I want to start by saying a couple things about ECU that I just want to say. First off, they've got some of the best fans in the conference. I really want them to be good because I think they've got a, I think the conference is better off when ECU is good at football. I really do. I think that it's just one of the best atmospheres you'll find when they're good, and they deserve that. Secondly, I want to point out that if they had fired Ruffin McNeil 1 year earlier than they did, which was a disaster and they shouldn't have done because they handled everything wrong since then, if they had fired him 1 year earlier, they could have had Lincoln Riley head coach because he was their OC before that.
Ooh.
He took the Oklahoma OC job 1 year before Ruffin McNeil was fired. So if they 1 year earlier, you at least get 1 or 2 years of Lincoln Riley there.
Yeah, but then you're probably still in the same situation.
Yeah, but at least you just had Lincoln Riley.
Okay, fair. That's fair.
UCF's in that situation. Memphis is in that situation where they're turning over coaches because they're too good. I'd rather that. And, well, we went from Scotty Montgomery's disaster to, you know.
Yeah, Scotty Montgomery got a raw deal out of that. I don't think he deserves to be criticized as much as he did because they put him in a tough situation. And there was no, like, they fired the coach that was doing just fine. And then they told Scotty, hey, you got to do the exact same thing that he did, only we fired him for doing what we want you to do. And it's like, I don't know. I just.
It was an awkward spot. It was. Now we got Mike Houston, though. And I really like Mike Houston as a head coach. He's shown on the field improvement. He has not really shown all that much improvement in the win-loss column, though, which is unfortunately what you're judged by at the end of the day for a head coach. You are what your record says you are. You know, if you just look at last year, they were blown out 3 times by UCF, Georgia State somehow, and Cincinnati. Then they go to Navy without Holton Ahlers and put up a good fight, but they were missing their starting quarterback. He was out for contact tracing issues. They beat Tulsa. I'm just going to say they beat Tulsa last year. Tulsa got the win, but ECU won that game. The referees botched multiple calls in the last couple of minutes of that game that handed it to Tulsa. And we all know how good they were last year. And then they crushed SMU. So they had a 45-7 halftime lead on SMU. The amount of inconsistency was absolutely stunning from them. And it just doesn't make sense. It's the same inconsistency that their quarterback Holton Ahlers has had. And I think those two probably go together.
Yeah. I'm going to jump to this real quick and then we'll dive into the actual players. But the one thing that I thought was interesting is that under Mike Houston in the last 3 years, the offense has improved. So last year they scored 22.8 points per game. And last year they were all the way up to 30.2. So they've improved by 8 points a game. The only problem is that their defense hasn't gotten any better. And it's a big reason why Mike Houston was brought in is to fix this defense. And his first year, they gave up nearly 40 points a game at 37.3.
Yeah.
And it's 2 years later and they just gave up 35.4. So that's the side of the ball that needs to improve. The offense is obviously doing its part, but you talked about Ahlers too, and Ahlers is a guy who also fits into the needs more consistency. And we talked about this last week, especially against Cincinnati. Like he had the one game we talked about, 535 yards and 6 touchdowns, but the other 2 games in the last 3 years,
he had 87 yards last year.
Yeah, it was just awful.
187.
Yeah, and we talked about this. It means he's due for 500 yards this year, so he's gonna dominate. But it's just like.
It's the funniest thing because I was going through his like game log of stats, and the week before he threw 87 yards against Cincinnati. He had the most yards he threw all season for 351 against Tulane. And I know Cincinnati is a better defense than Tulane, but they're not that much better than Tulane.
Almost 500 yards against SMU the next week or 2 weeks later.
He had a big number against them. But like I said, they had a 45-7 halftime lead. Then they came out in the second half and were laid an egg until like one late touchdown to take the, to like secure it. No, he had, as I wrote this down, he had three games of a 50% or lower completion rate. And that was Cincinnati, UCF, and Temple. So he didn't care if you were good or bad last year. He might just throw a dud game at you. Gosh. And then he had two games where he was 69% or higher in terms of his completion percentage. And that was, I believe, SMU and Tulane. He has all the tools to be basically what Sam Ellinger was at Texas or Tim Tebow was at Florida. He's a big, strong guy who can run well. He's not the most accurate thrower you've ever seen, but he can get the ball there. And he's a decent decision maker. He just needs to do it all the time instead of sometimes he does this well and sometimes he does that well.
Yeah, Holden Ahlers is the roller coaster that sometimes you want to ride, but at the same time, you know that there's a big drop off coming. And he's just like, well, I'm not sure if I'm ready for that.
Yeah, no, he is a great gambling man's fantasy quarterback. Is he could win you a game by himself, but you know, he's going into a senior year now though. I think, yeah, I'm not crazy. This is going to be a senior year.
Yeah, it'll be
at some point. It needs to come.
I don't know with COVID, like, does it, is he still a junior?
His fourth year playing, let's call it.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Not, fourth year starter now.
We're already worried about red shirts and stuff. It's like,
yeah, yeah. I'm not going to worry about that. He's a fourth year starter. He's an academic senior. He needs to put it together at this point. There's no more excuses. You're not still developing. You're not learning new, you know, Scotty Montgomery year one as a freshman, whatever, put it aside. Year two, well, you're still young and you've got a new system. Year three, COVID, I'm no excuses for him. He needs to put a full year together. And if he does, that's how ECU makes a bowl game, because their defense, it's not going to be good enough to win them any games at the end of the day. They might, you know, they might win games 35-31. They're not winning a lot of games 20-17. Yeah. Just not.
And it's in an Oilers' first 2 years, I think the tough part for that with consistency was there was no running game at all. Like they had,
oh no, they're terrible.
They were horrendous. And then last year to start the year, it was kind of the same thing. It was like, well, if Oilers gets some yards on the ground, then that's it. But then, you know, Rajay Harris emerges kind of later in the season. Mm-hmm. And, you know,
Penix is transferring out though.
What's that?
Penix is transferring out though.
Yeah, he's transferring out, but then
but he wasn't that good anyway. So
yeah, so that you know they have Rajay Harris emerge, which you know something that we haven't seen from them in a few years, just because I don't know why they just running the ball was just a big struggle for them, and
yeah,
it wasn't easy. You know, Harris obviously took over as the go-to guy, but then Keaton Mitchell, another freshman, was right behind them. They combined for over 1,000 yards.
Mm-hmm.
And now you have kind of maybe some balance here. And I think one thing that Ehlers is going to like is that I feel like his first 2 years, it was him just trying to figure things out because there was no support in the rushing. Mm-hmm. And now he has that. In addition to still having options downfield. So you look at, you know, CJ Johnson. I mean, CJ Johnson only had 19 catches last year, but he had 405 yards, which is 21.3 yards per catch. And he led the team with 6 touchdowns. So like, but he did a lot when he got the ball.
I had to do a double take when I was looking up guys' numbers earlier today, you know, getting ready, because I said 19, that can't be right. Then I looked at it, in 2019 as a freshman, he had 54 catches. So I'm not sure. I watched probably 4 or 5 ECU games last year, and I still feel like every single play was about CJ Johnson. I just don't know when he dropped off or how the numbers got that low. I know that, you know, people are focusing on him more, but still I was very surprised because it felt like he was around the ball much more than that.
It's crazy what he did even with limited, and I don't really, I don't remember him getting hurt at all. And I don't know why.
I don't think he missed time because of COVID either or anything like that. Well,
the other thing too, I was like, there's so many COVID things that it could have been that. And I just don't know. But,
yeah,
you know, there are also, I mean, Tyler Steen and Blake Prohl had over 100 catches between the two of them. So,
yeah. So I think it may have just, to an extent, it could have just been double teams on Johnson opening those two up. You know, I was surprised Prohl went to the NFL early, to be honest with you. I didn't. He didn't end up getting undrafted, and he was probably could have used another year at ECU. You mentioned Tyler Snead. I love Tyler Snead. I think he's an elite returner, and as far as a slot receiver goes, exactly what you're looking for. So I think that he's going to probably be a key part of that offense. but I want to double back to helping out Ehlers. Rajay Harris can do that a lot, not just by running, but getting better in the pass blocking game, because that offensive line of theirs is small. It's undersized, and they're going to have trouble against the better D lines, like Cincinnati, say.
Yeah, it's gonna be a big key, obviously. And ECU returned some guys, even though they lost Deontay Smith in the NFL. You know, mm-hmm. they return quite a few guys that are going to be solid for them. I think there's a lot of competition, but
Deontay Smith didn't play much last year. I think he only played in one game.
Yeah, right. So he was, even though he's still the best lineman that they had, but talent like him is obviously going to hurt. And there's a lot of competition on that side of the ball, at least on the offensive line. But there's talent to go there and compete and make life easier for Holton Ehlers. And like you said, I agree that Harris is going to need to not only run the ball again, but pass block, because Ehlers needs times to throw. And if he's not going to be able to throw, we're just going to see another roller coaster season. So that'll be interesting to see. I'm not really super worried about the offense. It's the defense that's some. However, the more I watch them, there are some guys on this defense that I am really falling in love with. And
They're on the secondary, though, right?
The secondary, I actually really like the linebackers, too.
I've got one name on the defensive line that I think could step up and do something next year. That's Rick DiAbreu. Other than
that, I like
him,
too. I think he's solid. But everybody else is like, I need to see more.
I think that D-line's going to get pushed around other than him.
Yeah, and that's the thing is, when I went back and watched a little bit of ECU's defense, there were a lot of plays where they made the right call. Like, they had the right call in place. There's just one or two guys that either cheat on their assignment or just miss their gap, and that's where the play went. So if they can become more disciplined, they're going to be in position. They might not be an elite defense by any means. They might not even be like good, but they just need to be.
But you don't have to be a good or elite defense really in the American, especially if you're just trying to make a bowl game. Because let's face it, ECU is not competing for the conference championship. They're trying to make a bowl game. And this defense is designed in the way I think a lot of those UCF teams that were very good had their defenses designed, and that it's designed to bend and force turnovers. Last year, they had 18 forced turnovers in 9 games. That was 25th in the country, tied for 25th technically. That's excellent for a defense that we were just talking about was laying up 35 something points a game. If they can force a couple more turnovers, maybe not get pushed around so much in the run game, they'll be decent enough to give their offense the chance to win games.
Yeah, they don't need to be a defense that's only giving up 10 points a game. That's just not going to happen. Like, Marshall led the entire country last year at like 13. And that's with how college football is going and where everything's favored towards the offense, even if they're giving up 24 points a game, that's an 11-point swing in what they were doing last year. So they don't have to be like, they just have to be decent. And so if the four is going to be like a big thing there. Bruce Bivens is decent. I think he's fine at linebacker. Xavier Smith, who led the team in tackles, is good. I like him. I think he's fun to watch. Jerry Wilson, he's a linebacker.
I think he might be their most important player coming
he's
into next year.
He's so good. I think he's my favorite player on that defense. His versatility is just insane. Because I watched when I was watching them. Originally, I watched them against UCF. I'm still watching them. Like, they put it, you know, Wilson's in the box and he's playing linebacker. And I'm like, okay, that means automatically I just assume that he doesn't have speed. You know, he might be
able especially to, on ECU, because you have this like little tick about ECU linebackers. Right. That no
good. And then I watched him later in the game, and there's a play made against one of UCF's wide receivers. And, you know, UCF's thing is that they have fast guys. And I'm like, who made that play? And it's Wilson. I'm like, holy cow. And then I look at the roster this year and he's listed as a safety. So it's like
that. Yeah, he'll be good for them in nickel defense.
Yeah, it'll be insane because you don't have to bring – you can keep him at linebacker and not have to bring an extra defensive back because you already have one.
Yeah, between him, Jaquan McMillan, and Sean Dorso, I think it's going to be a – good ECU secondary, all things considered. I think they're going to be able to force a lot of turnovers. Like I said, though, they just, I don't think the defensive line is going to be able to hold its water. And I don't think teams are going to bother throwing on them all that much because they're just not going to have to.
Yeah, McMillan is an all-conference talent. He's going to be solid. You throw in Malik Fleming on the other side. He has potential to be all-conference. And then joining the secondary is North Carolina transfer DJ Ford. And
which is that Ford's really a good player.
Likes him. They said he had a really good spring. He's a long, rangy, intelligent safety that they really, really like. So I think the back half of that defense is going to be just fine. But you got to get some pressure, and I just don't want to get for that line.
I think it's just if you let up 6 yards of rush, there's no reason to throw. And I think that's just where they're at. And if they can force the odd turnover, which I know they're capable of by last year's standards, then they're going to do what they have to do to put Ehlers in position to score more points than a lot of the teams on their schedule, which is all at some points that they're going to have to do is just outscore and just win the shootout.
All right, well, that's a perfect transition to the actual schedule. So first, before we do a deep dive into the schedule, what do you think the ceiling is for them, and what is the floor?
The ceiling for me is 8-4. The floor is 2-10. Holy. I think this is an incredibly ranging schedule, depending on your perspective. I think it comes down to how they do out of conference. It'll dictate their entire season.
Yep.
I think they'll go 6-6. If I had to make an actual prediction on it now, I'd say 6-6.
Yeah, I think I agree with you there, but
we'll go through it and see if we end up there.
So we start with a really underrated game, in my opinion, on September 2nd against Appalachian State,
a neutral site,
which is really cool. Normally it's you reserve those games to Miami, Alabama, Georgia, Clemson, and it's nice to see ECU, Appalachian State. Like, I'm going to be watching that game. It's a Thursday night game, and it's going to be on ESPNU. I think it's really exciting. And, if there's a team that you can get your season going against, it's a good one would be Appalachian State, who is still a good team in the Sun Belt, but I don't think it's the Appalachian State team that we've seen in the past.
They need to find a new quarterback at Appalachian State. And I think that means that, especially in week one, they're vulnerable.
Yes.
And I think don't get me wrong, that's a good Appalachian State team. Coastal Carolina and Louisiana largely made us forget about them in the Sun Belt last year, but that Appalachian State team is still really good. I think they had two losses last year. They're a step off away from those teams that we think about in the Sun Belt from last season.
Yep.
So they could very well be right there if they find a quick replacement for Zach Thomas.
Yeah, Chase Bryce comes in from Duke, former Clemson.
I don't think Chase Bryce is the guy, though. I don't think so either.
But that's another one of the options that people will be talking about.
These guys, when they're on their third school, because they realize they weren't going to start at Clemson, whatever, transfer, get to Duke. And if you can't be the guy at Duke, you're not that good.
If you can't thrive, I mean, it's not like Duke's going to beat a bunch of teams, but if you can't succeed with David Cutcliffe.
That's the other thing is he had David Cutcliffe coaching him and he still stunk.
So I don't know what's going to happen there, which is too bad. Cause like he did decently at Clemson. So I don't know if maybe it's, I don't know. We'll see, but that's a game that honestly ECU should win that game given what they have coming back. But
you never know because Appalachian State has the mentality of a winner and ECU does not rank
the Giant Killers.
There's a cultural difference between the two programs right now, which it's just hard. It's hard to think ECU wins that game and have confidence going into it, even though I think on paper they probably are the better team.
Right. And then that leads us. So let's say they are 1-0. If they're 0-1, this next game is a definite loss then.
Oh, see, South Carolina is in. I've talked myself into ECU over South Carolina.
Hey, I'm okay with that.
It's first off, it's at ECU, and it's a noon kick on ESPN2. I think it's going to be it's just going to be one of those games where South Carolina walks in, new coaching staff, a lot of changes, a lot of turnover. I think they're going to walk in a little bit sleepy into a place that can be a real tough place to play against a team that really is going to want to beat them. And I think ECU can catch them. I know it's not promised that they'll catch them, but I think that ECU could easily win that game.
Well, here's the thing. South Carolina's next game is against Georgia, too.
Oh yeah,
like that's a trap game. Like we can build beat Georgia.
Yeah, on the road at ECU before going to Georgia, I think that's absolutely a trap game for a team that's got a new coach and doesn't 100%, know what's going on yet.
Yeah, so that's still two tough games. Like even though both teams, both Appalachian State and South Carolina, are kind of headed in the wrong direction, that's still two decent games for them. So say that they are 2-0, then I think this is the toughest game on their schedule
at Marshall. I think it's hard to predict what Marshall's going to be, though, because they're a team who went and changed coaches for next to no reason, if you ask me. I guess the reason was they weren't winning the Conference USA Championship, but that's not a good reason to change your coach who's getting you there or getting you just below there every year.
Right. No reason. It's a Scotty Montgomery situation. It's like your expectations don't match what you're going to get.
Yeah. Yeah. They lost a couple of their good offensive linemen to the transfer portal too. So I'm not 100% sure that Marshall's going to be that same team that they were last year.
Their defense would be good.
Yeah. I was going to say, with that being said, they're still last year's Marshall team was still years ahead of last year's ECU team. And I don't expect ECU to win this game at all. I think they split the South Carolina App State game. So when it comes down to it, they'll get one of those. I think they'll lose to Marshall. And I think they better be Charleston Southern. If they lose to Charleston Southern, we've got big issues.
Yeah, I think 2-2 is like a realistic expectation.
I think that should be the goal, is 2-2. Any better and you've walked out of the out-of-conference very lucky.
Right, yep. And that just has to do with more of the inconsistencies with this team. Now, if the D-line all of a sudden becomes world beaters and Holt Naylor's figures things out, was a realistic possibility.
Yeah, if Ehlers has 4 straight of his good games, they're 4-0. I don't even care about the defensive line at that point.
It was bad games then, so.
Yeah, which means, come conference play, he's going to be throwing the ball in the dirt and tripping up for himself.
Well, so then we get out of non-conference play, and then we dive into the conference play, and the first two games aren't exactly easy at all. First off,
I'm about to get homecoming.
Game that Tulane is a team that I think a lot of people project to be one of the best in the conference. So I think that there's a lot to worry about with that game. And honestly, it'll really determine how good ECU is actually going to be in the conference. So we kind of get an idea early on in this conference play.
Yeah. Yeah. This is one of those games I expect to be one of ECU shootouts over the course of the season that you're going to see. And it really, to me, it comes down to, do they force enough turnovers? Can they turn over Michael Pratt the way Michael Pratt was a little bit prone to turn over the ball late in games last season? If they can still do that to him, then they've got a good shot of winning this in a shootout. I don't see them holding Tulane to less than about 35 points, though. So they're going to need to go out there and get on their horse and run.
Yep, and that's what they'll have to do with some of these teams, is they're just going to have to outscore them, and that's not, I don't know, it's not.
But like I said, it's not just outscore, it's force a turnover at the right time, too.
Yep, exactly. I think 2017 UCF.
Yeah, I'd argue the 2017 UCF team was a little bit better rounded than this.
Oh, 100%, but the same idea of just like UCF's defense wasn't great. They weren't a great defense. They were just opportunistic that year.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I've been trying to get at this whole time, is ECU needs to be an opportunistic defense, especially with the talent in their secondary and the lack thereof on their front seven. But then after – so I'd say we can agree that the Tulane game is a little bit of a coin flip as of right now.
Yeah, next game's a loss.
At UCF. Yeah. They're not going to – TBA for time. Doesn't matter. They're going to lose if it's prime time, if it's Friday night, if it's noon on a Saturday.
Owl's house. So
they've lost that game before they're walking into it, I think.
I will say a 5-0 ECU team against a 5-0 UCF team would be crazy.
I don't know if UCF will be 5-0 by then, because they've got, first off, they can't be, because they only have 4 games before ECU. So take that. Boise State, Louisville, Navy, Bethune-Cookman. That's who UCF has before that. So maybe 4-0, I'd say. But won't be 5-0, I can promise you that much.
Oh, that's fair. Well, then, even then, they get a week off after that.
Then they head out to your Houston Cougars. And I think that's going to be a very interesting game for me, because, we've talked about Houston a bunch on this show just today. Houston could be one of a few different things, and we don't know what they'll be just yet. If they come along and start developing the way they should under Dana, then there's a good shot that Houston runs them out of the building because this is at Houston. If not, ECU has every right to go in there and beat them up at home.
If ECU wins this game, I don't like where Houston's headed, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's at Houston, so I think Houston should win this football game. I don't like to say, like, Houston has no chance because they're inconsistent because ECU's inconsistent.
Houston is pissed if they lose this game.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm sure they'll be calling for Dana to get bought out and figure out the next step. But
yep.
It's tough, though, because both teams are incredibly inconsistent. It's a shootout.
Yeah. And I feel like that's just going to be a lot of ECU games this year. They're just going to have to figure it out as they go on the offensive side of the ball.
I've got two more wins for them coming up, though. So USF, Temple, both of them at home, back-to-back weeks. I think you can mark those both down as wins.
Yeah, I think the USF game has potential to be a coin flip, but I think, yeah, right now I see that as a win for ECU. And then I think we can both agree it's probably 1-2 to finish the year here.
Most likely, but...
You think they beat Memphis?
At Memphis, maybe not.
Oh, wait, they're beating Cincinnati, though, because holding...
We talked about that last week.
So...
So 3-0 to end the year.
3-0 to end the year. So look at that.
No, it's
3.
I think Memphis is the favorite to win that game. I don't give ECU no shot to win, though. Think about it like this. You've got a senior quarterback going into a road environment. You've got an offense that's capable of putting up a lot of points and defense that's capable of forcing turnovers against. We're not 100% sure of the quarterback yet because they've got so many to choose from. Grant Gunnell, probably. A running back situation that we talked about is a kind of a mystery. A defense that lost a lot of guys and wasn't very good to begin with. I'm not saying it's a great chance. And that's putting a lot of negativity on Memphis's shoulders, but by no means is that a surefire loss the way it would have been 2 years ago, say.
Yeah, if they're 6-3 heading into this game, then it's definitely a coin flip. But I think anything worse than that, I put Memphis as the favorite, unless Memphis just implodes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't expect Memphis to be a bad team next year by any means. They've been recruiting very well. They should have the talent to replace those guys. It's one of those things you have to prove it first. And ECU, we both expect will take a little bit of a step forward too.
Yep.
So one team comes back low, another takes a little step forward. We'll see if they meet in the middle. They should beat Navy, right? I'm not crazy. They should go into Navy and win that game.
Yeah, I agree.
Navy is one of those teams that's impossible to judge before the season gets going, but I don't think Navy's going to be good next year. I don't know who their quarterback is. Carruthers is out, and he was their best offensive player last year anyways. It's tough to say that they'll be good.
Their defense will be solid. That's like their saving grace. But
yeah, I really like Newberry, the D coordinator there. But and then Cincinnati, who we talked as the worst game Cincinnati could have scheduled there, an absolute monster of a trap before the American Championship game.
Is going off for 500 yards. I'm just
it's at ECU. It's not going to be any fun for Cincinnati. Cincinnati's going to win the game. Even if Holton Ehlers throws for 500 yards.
You're 100% wrong. You heard it here first. This is insider access. ECU is going to beat Cincinnati because Holton Ehlers is a lot of numbers. He's due for a 500-yard game. He's going to go off, and they're going to win.
But think about everything that I've been saying about ECU's front seven, which is that they're non-existent. They're small. They get pushed back. Think about everything you know about Cincinnati's offensive design.
Yes, and also the Holton Ehlers is going against the one biggest strength of the entire Cincinnati team.
But yeah,
that's all. You only need to know one stat. Don't look at anything else. I don't care about the offensive line. I don't care about the defensive line. I don't care that Cincinnati's defensive secondary is super good. The only thing that matters is that 2 years ago, Holton Ehlers threw for over 500 yards, and because he didn't do it the first and the third year, that means he's due throwing 500 yards. That means ECU is going to win.
All right. whatever you say, I'm going to try to figure out what, how I actually got them to 6-6, because I had a whole Word document doing it. Yeah. So,
well, so you go 2-2 to start.
And then I got
win two losses against Tulane and UCF. That's 2-4. Houston game, you said, is probably a coin flip. I mean, between Houston, Memphis, and Cincinnati, those are the other games that you can get losses for.
So. Yeah, I mean, I've got 4-4 counting the USF and Temple games with the out of conference. Then you've got Navy, that's 5. And then I think you just have to, between Memphis, Tulane, Houston, flip a coin and say one of those three they'll have to come up heads on, right?
Yeah, ECU's due for, even if they're not great, they're due for one or two games where they win and you're like, how did that even happen? So that's,
yeah, the SMU game last year, who unfortunately for ECU they don't get to play because they feast on SMU for whatever reason.
Well, because SMU can't play defense.
Yeah, and SMU doesn't. I went back and watched that game a couple of days ago, knowing that we had ECU coming up. I just wanted to see them, like, their last game of the season last year. I knew they played a good team. And it was incredible because, you know, the commentators are talking the start of the game. I completely forgot this. SMU had a decent, not a very good, but a decent chance to still make the conference championship game if they won that game and basically got a Tulsa loss. So then I think various factors made it so that Tulsa never played the game they would have had to lose to miss the conference championship game, but that's how 2020 was. But they just came out and they just looked like their season was already over, like they didn't care anymore. And I thought that was, I think that's the biggest, not to derail and start talking about SMU too much, but that's the biggest issue they've had in recent years, is they just randomly lay these dud eggs where they just don't seem motivated for a game they should be.
Yeah, that's where I'm excited to see where Sonny Dykes can take them, if he can bring them to avoid those kind of games. But we'll talk about SMU eventually. We'll get there. But yeah, ECU is a very intriguing team. There's a lot of room for growth, but there's also a chance that they stay where they're at. I think a lot of people think that they are going to go to that growth path and see what happens there. Yeah. That wraps ECU here. I believe next we have Houston, so that's going to be another interesting team preview to talk about. There's a lot to discuss.
It's going to be me saying this game's a coin flip the whole time because
just like coin flip the entire season. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see. But yeah, like I said, that's a wrap for the ECU team preview. Make sure that you go back and listen to the Cincinnati preview. We're doing one a week until we get to the season. And it's going to be exciting to see what we both discuss. There's already been some things that have been interesting to hear you say, and I think that there's going to be a lot of good discussion going forward, at least to end the season. Dan, you have anything else you want to say about ECU before we head out here?
Go Pirates.
Go Pirates. Like Dan said, life is better when ECU is playing at a high level, when ECU is good. So maybe Holton Ehlers does put it together. Maybe he figures out a way to throw for over 500 yards against Cincinnati. Until then, stay tuned, and we will see what happens if ECU can actually meet those expectations.